Last lecture, I think the topic that we got up through was the formation of imines and enamines. So I believe we covered the difference between primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary amines or ammonium salts. We talked about how a primary amine could react with an aldehyde or ketone to make an imine. And we talked about how a secondary amine would react with an aldehyde or ketone to make an enamine. What we hadn't talked about yet is why is it that a primary amine cannot react to form an enamine? I might have said, made a little comment about it, but I don't think we covered it at all. Does anybody happen to know why it is that a primary amine cannot be used to form an enamine? Well, an enamine is close related to what other functional group that has an ene name in it? An enol, which has got a OH group on the same position as a double bond. Are enols something that we normally can isolate? No, why not? They're not thermodynamically favorable, they're unstable, they'll tautomerize. And that's exactly what normally an enamine would do. The only reason that enamines form is because there's not enough removable hydrogens to form the double bond between carbon and nitrogen. So if you had, let's say, an aldehyde, for example, that you reacted with H plus and a primary amine, in theory, we could write a mechanism in which an enamine would be formed, but then it's going to rapidly tautomerize. So to review the mechanism of tautomerization, the carbon-carbon double bond gets protonated first. Oops. I left a hydrogen out of my first structure, so please go back and add that in. We have a lone pair that can delocalize. And it's actually at this point, if you look at the mechanism for forming an enamine, how we showed why an imine can't form. Because if you had had a secondary amine, then this positive charge would have nowhere to go, you could say. But because we do have a removable hydrogen, it can come off, which would make the nitrogen neutral. Now, as we go from the enamine, let me just remind us of this name. As we go from the enamine to the imine, what happens? Well, we have a carbon-nitrogen bond that breaks. A nitrogen-hydrogen bond. I'm looking from the reverse perspective. So the carbon-nitrogen bond forms. The nitrogen-hydrogen single bond breaks. We have the carbon-hydrogen bond that that forms, and then we have a carbon-carbon bond that breaks. And if we were to look up these different bond association energies, remember that any time the bond breaks, that requires energy, so that's a positive value. Any time a bond forms, that releases energy, so that's a negative value. overall, to go from the enamine to the imine, it's overall negative. Yes. The imine is the final product.
Okay. So you just put there for...
Because it's the... Well, so I could write the rest of this to the left. That's pretty much it, though, for imines and enamines as far as mechanism. So I don't know that I would ask you to prove this on a question, but if I'm taking the time to point out which bonds might form or break, it might be a worthwhile exercise for you to maybe go and investigate and look those numbers up and prove that really this would be favorable. Yes?
Which
CH bond is formed? Well, notice that the first step is for the carbon-carbon double bond to react with H+. So that's a carbon-hydrogen bond that gets formed right there. Now, there's a reaction of not imines, but a close relative of imines that we were supposed to cover the same day. The Wolff-Kishner reduction, if any of you had checked on the syllabus. So there's two closely related derivatives of imines that I want to show you now. One of them you get from the molecule hydrazine, which is quite a reactive molecule, sometimes found in rocket fuels along with a lot of other nitrogen-containing compounds. And it's effectively two amines stuck one nitrogen to the other. But this compound still has a lot of the reactivity of a plain old amine. And so if you took, for example, a ketone and reacted it with hydrazine under mildly acidic conditions, we'll get something that looks like an imine, but it's something actually known as a hydrazone. Similarly, there's another molecule that has the name hydroxylamine. Now, I know that normally when we have hydroxy, there's no L that we put in. And this does have something to do with the nomenclature of amine. So don't worry about how to construct the name. Just realize that's the common name for this molecule. Nitrogen is more basic than the oxygen is. So effectively, the nitrogen's more nucleophilic than the oxygen. So if we did the same type of reaction, we reacted a ketone with this hydroxylamine in an acid source, we're also going to form something that looks like an imine. It's just that it's got this OH group hanging off of it. So this kind of functional group is called an oxime. Now, practical uses of oximes, we probably won't get this quarter. We'll see a use next quarter. But there is this Wolff-Kishner reduction that I referred to a moment ago that is used for hydrazones. So let me show you that mechanism. So, if we start with a hydrazone, we put this in a strong concentrated solution of sodium hydroxide. Realize that sodium hydroxide has the potential to do other reactions. So, for example, if we had an alkyl halide on this molecule, we'd have to consider whether we could do this reduction or not, because maybe the alkyl halide would work instead. I'm only mentioning this because we are going to start doing more and more synthesis problems. I said we start this week. Don't quite have the time to squeeze it in today. But I want you to think about the compatibility of different functional groups and reagents as we keep adding on more reactions. So in sodium hydroxide, the following reaction is not favorable, but it can happen, or at least there's an equilibrium that can get established. We make a negative anion, that's the same thing. We make an anion that can be delocalized because it is neighboring a double bond. Now there's no H plus in solution because we have a sodium hydroxide solution, but because the first step is the removal of a hydrogen by sodium hydroxide, we can presume that water is around. So we could show water providing a hydrogen for this anion to become protonated. Now let me scoot the notes back down because I forgot to write up top here that between the two stars that I just wrote, so starting from the enamine and going to the imine, that is an example of tautomerization, which I said out loud, but I didn't write it down. Pointing that out, look at what I just wrote for the first part of this Wolff-Kishner reduction. What kind of process does this look like? It's also tautomerization. It's just a base version. So in the acid tautomerization we just saw, first the double bond attacks H+, and the last thing that happens is a hydrogen falls off. Well, in the base version, notice the first thing that happens is a hydrogen comes off, and then the double bond moves. So it's kind of like everything done in reverse. But so this much of it, between the brackets, that is base promoted tautomerization. Which I don't know if this much of it is favorable or not. But if the reaction continues, we're going to see in just a moment there's an irreversible step. So now that I've said that, let me expand on a comment that I made in lab, which is that normally for mechanisms, I've been saying that if you have an overall irreversible process, it's okay to just show forward arrows. But this is going to be one exception to it, because everything up to this point and just a little further is in fact fully reversible. But it's the very, almost the very last step of this process where irreversibility occurs. And I want you to know in this case, where does it make the switch? So what does happen next? Well, similar opening step, or similar to the opening step, we're going to deprotonate the nitrogen one more time. Potentially, we might imagine that there's a shift, a delocalization of those electrons, except we don't have a double bond next door to push open. If you tried to move a lone pair to the nitrogen, that would cause the nitrogen-carbon bond to break, which is exactly what happens. In that process, though, you make nitrogen gas, which, if nothing else, is going to bubble out of the reaction mixture. Well, if you're bubbling out of the mixture, then of course you can't have equilibrium, because all reactants and products have to remain in contact with each other if you're going to have a hope for equilibrium. So you end up with the anion.
It won't tack nitrogen backwards, especially since we do have something like water around in solution. So instead, we have a very rapid neutralization. And we form an alkane. So let me summarize this to say that the synthetic utility of this reaction, the Wolff-Kishner reaction, is to convert aldehydes and ketones to alkanes, which this is a form of reduction.
You might think, well, why would you want to do this? Because so far this quarter, we've been trying to put functional groups on. And we did learn about free radical halogenation last quarter, where I had discussed how alkanes are normally unreactive. Well, this may look like a potentially useless reaction in this case, but what if you had multiple functional groups? What if you had a plant-based source for some important component that you needed? It just happened to have one extra ketone on it. Well, then we might, if we're able to, be able to address that individual ketone, get rid of it, and get something that we want. So this is not a useless reaction. Just might be for the example that I showed you. So any questions about the mechanism, about this reduction? Yes? Oh, you know, I did put the bracket around the wrong thing. Thank you. Which means I used the wrong arrow here, too. Now it's correct. Other questions? Then the main thing I wanted to talk about today was to come back to Grignard reactions, because I believe that's might have been what was on the syllabus for the day, wasn't it? So even before we get to any discussion of mechanism or synthesis, I wanted to talk about the lab that you're going to start on Thursday, because Grignard reactions are notoriously difficult reactions. And part of the reason for that is because the Grignard reagents are so darn reactive. They can decompose in a number of ways. And so, in fact, that's the first thing I want to show you. Well, and I guess I'll briefly show you a mechanism that we're going to ignore. The only reason I'm showing you this mechanism is to discuss how, yeah, there's lots of reactions where I've been showing you these mechanisms, but that doesn't mean we understand all chemical reactions. Yes?
So should this be a lab?
Yes. It's information that could be testable in either place. And I might have made a comment like that last week, but it's going to be increasingly difficult to delineate between lab and lecture, because some cases, like the thermodynamic versus kinetic lab, every little bit of that is 100% lab lecture and 100% lecture. So this too, the formation and the destruction of Grignard reagents, is both a lecture and a lab topic. So the Grignard reagent mechanism, there's evidence that it's a radical mechanism. There's evidence that the first step involves magnesium interacting with the halogen that is on the alkyl halide used. Beyond that, there's not complete certainty about exactly what happens. So I'm going to show you a version of the mechanism. I'll tell you ahead of time that you're not going to see this on a quiz or exam. But even back when I took organic chemistry, this mechanism wasn't fully understood or known. So just showing you that what could be viewed as a small but fundamental question of chemistry, there's still plenty of those types of questions around. So here's one proposed version of how Grignard formation occurs. As I said a moment ago, it's thought that the first step involves magnesium metal and the halogen from an alkyl halide. Well, magnesium metal, the only thing it's able to do really is act as a reducing agent, which is exactly what sodium did when we did the reduction of alkynes using sodium. In a similar fashion, let's imagine that one of the electrons from magnesium comes off, which recall that magnesium is in the second group, so there's two valence electrons on it. So let's say one of the two electrons comes off in solution. Well then, that electron could potentially add to the alkyl halide. But, and this is going to be confusing, I recognize this, but you need to realize that there's no good way we could write the product that forms, not at least initially. Why? Because we have a compound where everything's already got sigma bonds. So where are we going to put the electron if everything that's already could be bonded is bonded? Well, where did it go in the case of the triple bond, when we reduce the triple bond and we add an electron into the system? Where did that electron go? Went into an antibond. Well, if you have a carbon-bromine single bond and you put an electron in the antibond, what do you have? A half bond. If you remember Ectochem 1A, bond order is number of bonding electrons minus number of antibond electrons divided by 2. Well, in the carbon-bromine bond, there's 2 electrons there. I'm adding a third electron in, which is going to be an antibonding electron. So 2 bonding minus 1 antibonding gives us 1 electron overall, but divided by 2, that means we only have half a bond. So there is a way we can notate it. Which I don't remember if I used this notation in the past or not. But what that means is this whole molecule has a negative charge somewhere, and it's got an extra electron somewhere. And it is, in fact, that extra electron that's causing the negative charge. So this is an intermediate known as a radical anion. And to more properly show how it reacts, I'm going to go ahead and show that half bond breaking, which formally I'm going to do with 2 arrows. Because remember, there's an antibonding electron, but 2 bonding electrons. It might make sense that on the basis of electronegativity, we expect the extra electron to show up on bromide. So we're going to end up with an alkyl, radical, and bromine ion. Of course, if we had magnesium that started this whole process off and it lost 1 electron, we've got magnesium plus floating around somewhere. Yes?
Since you have Br minus, so that's mean the lone electron goes to Br.
Yes. And now that we've got a plus and minus charge together, we could imagine the bromide rapidly meets up with that magnesium. And we form the magnesium bromide radical. Of course, we have an alkyl radical in solution as well. So imagine that the 2 radicals come together. We now have our Grignard reagent. Now, back to what I was really wanting to get to is, how do these Grignard reagents decompose, or what can affect them? So Grignard reagents, number 1, can be destroyed by water or any other protic molecules. This is why you're drying your glassware for so long. because glass intrinsically has a certain amount of water that's automatically absorbed onto its surface, because the surface of glass has so many OH bonds on it. If you recall, that's why we used a chopped up version of glass as the coating for our TLC plates. You can take advantage of the fact, though, that Grignard reagents react with water if we wanted to try to deuterate a compound.
So, for example, if we take an alkyl halide and we react it with magnesium and ether, which I did comment about THF and ether, did I not?
That in order to form a Grignard reagent, you have to have an ethereal type solvent present, because the oxygen complexes with the magnesium as the Grignard reagent gets formed. No ether or something like THF, no Grignard reagent. Okay, let me leave it here though, because I'm going to add to this list. Yes? From magnesium. If I'd said earlier in the lecture that magnesium, being in group 2, has 2 valence electrons, so I said imagine one comes off. Ionization energy. If you have enough energy in solution, it can come off. Same way that sodium provided the source of electrons for an alkyne reduction.
All right, so here we get the Grignard reaction, reagent, react it with D2O, we could put a deuterium on here. Something else we didn't, I don't think, talk about yet is that carbon dioxide is also a problem. Now, you could take advantage of that if you wanted to, in one way of synthesizing carboxylic acids. If you wanted intentionally to make a carboxylic acid, there's kind of a neat trick you could do where you make your Grignard reagent first, and maybe not quite literally, but you pour it over dry ice. Dry ice is nothing more than solid carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide you could view as being nothing more than a double carbonyl, carbon that's got 2 carbon-oxygen double bonds. So one or the other gets attacked, and we end up with a carboxylate. Part of the reason that this is such a favorable process is because the Grignard reaction is very, very exothermic. Dry ice is very, very cold. So the combination of the two works out well. There is one more byproduct or one more thing that can destroy Grignard reagents, and that's oxygen. So same thing, start out by making a Grignard reagent, and then over time, just in the presence of oxygen, we'll make a peroxide. Now let me make the summary statement, and then this is where we're going to slip more completely into lab mode. And here's the statement. The Grignard reagents are ideally formed in flame-dried, or in our case, oven-dried, glassware under inert atmosphere. Which that might not be a phrase that we've seen before, but that means to do a chemical reaction where instead of just normal surrounding lab atmosphere, you've instead got your glassware filled and sealed off with something like nitrogen or argon, a gas that's not going to be reactive. Now, we don't have the gas facility. So when you look and do your pre-labs, if you look at the experimental setup, they are going to be somewhat open.
The water we're going to do the best to get rid of by the fact that we did put the glassware in the oven and the fact that we're using a drying tube. Carbon dioxide and oxygen we're not going to rigorously exclude. We're just going to depend on the fact that those reactions, since it's gas versus liquid, are somewhat slower than water, which might seep into solution, which definitely is a problem in these green yard reagents. Now, flipping over into lab mode, let me tell you about getting green yard reagents to form. Because part of the problem is that magnesium develops a layer of magnesium oxide. You know, just put magnesium metal out, a redox reaction in oxygen occurs. We end up with a thin, thin layer of magnesium oxide, which has to be stripped away or eaten through in order for the reaction to begin. So if we were to do an ideal Grignard reaction, instead of just taking these magnesium turnings that you used, we would crush it up or powderize it even better, increase the surface area, strip off that top surface of magnesium oxide, make the beginning of the formation of that a reagent easier. We don't have that. So what can we do next? Well, unlike what would normally make sense to do, sometimes getting these reagents to form is easier if you don't mix the solution. Because if you have these magnesium turnings that are at the bottom of a flask, and you drop some ether in there just to have a solvent around, because remember, if you don't have a solvent, you can't get a Grignard reaction. Have a little bit of ether, but then drop some drops of the alkyl halide and let them settle down in the bottom of the flask. That way it covers up the magnesium, and then anywhere where a little hole does get eaten through that top oxidative layer, well, the reaction can start. How do you know the reaction is working? There's several clues. One, on the magnesium metal itself, there'll be tons of little itty-bitty tiny bubbles, which you gotta make sure that you distinguish from boiling. Ether does have a low boiling point. Forming and reacting Grignard reagents are both exothermic. Exothermic enough that you may cause the solvent to boil even without using a hot plate. So if you have big bubbles, the whole solution turning over, that might be boiling. But if you see like little bitty tiny bubbles, maybe if you had, imagine a soft drink or something like that, lots of bubbles coming off the metal, that's one indicator the reaction's occurring. Another indicator is that the solution often will turn cloudy or turn a certain color. Now, cloudiness is not always a good thing, because often that means that you've made the Grignard reagent, but it started reacting with whatever trace amount of water might be around. But at least it means that you could see that something's going on. What if you don't see any of that? Is there anything you can do to encourage a Grignard reaction? Sometimes just waiting, especially if you're doing a large-scale reaction. The problem is you could add all of the alkyl halide at once, and so that once the reaction gets initiated, it just keeps on going. But once it gets going, it's exothermic, which means more of it happens, which means more energy is released. The whole process can cascade and get out of control. And so you can have Grignard reactions where you're ending up having stuff spurt out all over from the top of your glassware setup because of the sudden increase of temperature that you got. Then, of course, sudden temperature increase plus ether equals fire, so that's not necessarily good either. So you can't necessarily add all of your agent in at once and just hope it starts. So what can you do? Well, your procedure is going to tell you that sometimes adding a little tiny crystal of iodine helps, because iodine can react with magnesium metal, again, to help eat through the surface of that magnesium oxide layer. And then once it's eaten through, if you've got your regular alkyl halide around, then it can start reacting. Now, of course, this means you're going to use up some magnesium, but magnesium is relatively cheap, and we normally add it in excess. Which brings up another point: how can you tell that your reaction is actually successful? Well, the magnesium is going to get consumed, so the little bits of magnesium should shrink in size. We do have excess, so it's not going to totally disappear. But again, you'll see some of the magnesium disappear. What if nothing's working? Well, then I don't know if we have this available or not, but if you use something like diiodomethane, something where it's very small molecule that's got multiple halogens on it. That makes a byproduct, but sometimes they're more reactive than plain old larger alkyl halides. A last case resort for our purposes only is if you can't get the reaction to start, then you take a little piece of magnesium, put it in a test tube, you fill it with a little bit of ether, and you put a big old squirt of your alkyl halide in that test tube and stir it around until you get the reaction to go. Then very quickly, you pour that into your main reaction flask. That's horrible technique because there's no stoichiometry there. If you had a Grignard reagent that was really expensive to make, you wouldn't be able to take that alternate route. But just because this is an instructional lab and we want to have something work, you can get that side reaction and then toss it into your main flask. But just again, realize that's a huge cheat, you could say, that we're doing just to get the lab to proceed. So when you come in, you're going to set your glassware up, you're already going to have your magnesium in there, you're going to add some ether, you're going to add some of the alkyl halide, and I would say don't stir. Ignore the procedure. Let it just sit there until you can see if any of those little small bubbles form. Once you're sure the reaction has started, then you're going to want to slowly but continuously add your alkyl halide in. I forget how long of a time frame it says it wants you to do that over, but don't stop. Because once you get the reaction going, you want it to keep going. I think part of the reason it works that way is this is or has some aspect of a radical mechanism to it. So once you form radicals, you want them to keep on reacting. So that's a little bit of a side story about the Grignard reaction. I'll repeat some of this tomorrow or Thursday because I didn't write this down. And even if you did listen to it before then, you might forget when we come to lab because it's 7:30 in the morning. But questions or questions about anything lecture-wise that I've covered so far? Yes. No, that's taking a separate little test tube, taking the alkyl halide, the magnesium, mix them all together, and just hoping that you can get something going.
Okay, because the people have mentioned that you add reagent that's already been formed.
Uh-huh.
That will get it going.
It's kind of like what I was saying if you had that side flask that you could transfer a little bit in. So if you did have a neighbor that was having a successful reaction, take a tiny, tiny bit of that, because of course that's going to affect yield if you start messing with someone else's reaction flask. But yeah, if you got someone that's got any reaction going, you can take a little bit of that, transfer it to your own.
Why does that get involved?
Again, I'm guessing because of some radical type process. All right, so let's see what time we got left. Oh, not too much. Well, then let's flip back into lecture mode and let's view this in terms of synthesis. Because I've already said probably several times that the Grignard reaction is one of the more important synthetic reactions we learned this quarter. So you need to be able to take a product and determine how could it have been made if it had been made by a Grignard reaction. So let me give you this product. Now I'll give you just a little bit of time to work on this. So here's a form of benzyl alcohol. Probably has a very floral, fragrant smell in real life. And I'll just say, this was something formed by a Grignard reaction. What I'm going to ask you to do then is work retrosynthetically. Determine the carbonyl-containing compound and the Grignard reagent that could have been used to make this compound. And I'll give you 60 seconds or so to try to work on that. Now recall what the Grignard reaction is. Grignard reagent acting like it's an anion, directly attacking a carbonyl, pushing that carbonyl open, leaving an alcohol.
Alcohol.
Well, technically an alkoxide first, but then it gets protonated and you make an alcohol. The reaction, yes, it's a, you have a Grignard reagent that acts like it's an anion. The anion attacks the carbonyl, the carbon of the carbonyl, pushes the carbon-oxygen bond open. Yes, actually, if you go, I'm just repeating what's in your notes already. So if you go back to when we first got the Grignard reaction. Now, as you're working on this, let me make two statements that may help you. The first is realize that, yes, a Grignard reaction, a reagent does push a carbonyl open, and so that means whatever alcohol forms is located where the carbonyl used to be. So that should tell you a little bit about the type of compound you should come up with in order to synthesize this alcohol. Because that alcohol, that position right there, used to be part of a carbonyl. Now here's another realization, that this alcohol is formed because a Grignard reagent attacks. It makes a new carbon-carbon bond. Well, one of the carbons of that bond is that carbonyl compound, or is that carbonyl carbon, is where the alcohol ends up being formed. So the position where the alcohol is formed has to include the carbon that's part of that new carbon-carbon bond. That means, in this particular example, there are two ways we could analyze it. We could have looked at this and said, oh, well, what if a new carbon-carbon bond formed between benzene and that alcohol carbon? Or, what if it's actually the bond next door that had formed in this process instead? Let's look at the two approaches. So the one I have in green would imply that I had phenyl magnesium bromide. Why? Because it would attack that carbon that had the carbonyl, which is where the alcohol forms, which means I would have had to have had a 3-carbon aldehyde. Now, what if I took the opposite perspective, that the bond had formed the other way? Well, then the benzene ring would be attached to what would have had to have been the carbonyl carbon. There's only 2 other carbons available, and so ethyl magnesium bromide would have had to have been the Grignard reagent. Questions on that synthetic example? Now, a commentary then on mechanism of Grignard reactions. I tried to do a little bit of looking up of the mechanisms, not for making the Grignard reagent, but of the Grignard reaction itself. And it was kind of the same situation, though, as it was for the reagent, that I saw a number of proposed mechanisms where there may be evidence for more than one mechanism. But in other words, it's complicated enough that there's no one alternate mechanism that I would like to show you. So in any Grignard reaction, what you could do is the following in terms of mechanism. Because I've been saying that these compounds act as if they're anions, but instead of having to show a separate step where you formally produce an anion, you could make a shortcut notation that looks like this. I'll just take the last set of molecules here to show you this way of notating it, which is to take the bond from carbon to magnesium and just show it directly attacking. Since it's coming from between carbon and magnesium, it's implying that one of the two atoms is no longer connected to that bond. It would be understood by a chemist that you're implying the magnesium goes away, you could say. So it's a shorthand notation so that you don't have to show specifically making the anion first. Now we need to do some more synthetic examples of Grignard reagents, but that's almost the end of any mechanism information for the Grignard, except for a couple of small things. You've already seen acetylides as valid materials for opening up an epoxide. It might not be surprising then that a Grignard reagent could also open up an epoxide. This is still an anionic mechanism, and so attack is going to happen at the least substituted position. Notice that there's no oxygen now to help show the fact that an epoxide was attacked. So probably the meanest synthetic problem I could or would give you would involve a Grignard reaction that involves an epoxide. But before we build up to that type of level, here's a practice synthesis problem for you. Which we'll cover this at the beginning of class on Thursday. Yes. Any anionic opening of an epoxide happens at the less sterically hindered position. Any other last questions? Yes, Carolyn. What's that? The quiz is on Friday, yes. Not Thursday. Anything since the last exam? Now, I'm not going to be able to cover everything. The quiz isn't long enough. I think that if you're observant, you would all guess that some form of POD mechanism would probably be on that quiz, since we've made hydrates and imines and enamines and acetals and ketals and hemiacetals and hemiketals, and we had the same mechanism for all of them. But you haven't been asked for that mechanism yet on a quiz or an exam, have you? So that's one hint, possible hint, mechanism hint, that might be on the hint, quiz. Are you getting the point here? Of course, I just rattled off the names of a whole bunch of functional groups. Acetals, ketals, hemiacetals, hemiketals, imines, enamines, and hydrates. Seems like a reasonable series of functional groups, but I might ask you to write one of each of or something. Then we've got this Grignard reaction that I've said in all kinds of ways is going to feature prominently in synthesis. I've also just given you this example synthesis problem. One might connect the dots between those two thoughts. Does that help at all, Carolyn? Everybody else?